This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
My guest today is Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She is a friend of the show, an excellent thinker in the whole terrible, wonderful, momentarily necessary, I hope, field of the study of authoritarianism. She wrote the terrific book Strongmen, which I so strongly recommend, and is also the author of the excellent Substack newsletter, the Lucid newsletter with Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She is here today to talk with us about our usual subject, which is democracy and authoritarianism. And yes, unfortunately, Ruth, as we still are in 2023, it feels like while there may be a little bit of good news out there in the world here and there, the subject still remains vital to discuss because all of our other institutions seem to be in a period of very high stress. And authoritarianism still seems to be sort of, again, with a couple of small exceptions out in the world, creeping up on us. And so what I wanted to start with today, I made this sort of, I didn't mean it flippantly the other day, a comment about the House of Representatives. It feels like a legislative body in a failed state.
Mm-hmm.
And talk to us a little bit about how a legislative body, a Congress, a National Assembly of some kind, that is so dysfunctional and so weak and so rudderless and so leaderless and so held captive by its fringes, how that sort of thing contributes to the danger of a collapsing democracy and of an emergent authoritarian movement.
Yeah. So thanks for having me to continue our discussion. And it is a kind of an inflection point because the stakes couldn't be higher in the world of a giant, you know, a superpower with nuclear arms, the world's one of the world's, if not the world's most powerful military. The Congress of that nation is paralyzed because of the Republican Party. And, you know, it's our drama, which is not shared by many nations, is that we're a bipartisan republic. And one of the two parties is no longer in democracy anymore. They really have exited by all metrics. You know, they haven't just given up on bipartisanship now. And this has been developing for several years since Trump was in power too. And now they don't even tolerate internal dissent in their party. So they're threatening, you know, their own, of course, spectacularly on January 6th with Pence. So that's another step forward. And all of this dysfunction is a symptom of that they are not, they're not interested in governance in any democratic definition of that word. They're interested in other goals, which are primarily nihilistic, destructive, violent, corrupt, autocratic goals.
You know, I look at I posted this morning, and people thought I was being flippant when I described Matt Gaetz as sort of like a Robespierre figure right now, where he is a single person with enormously destructive instincts, who has a disproportionate amount of power in the temporary power, but that's going to lead down a road that will not end the way he thinks. I mean, I think people like Matt Gaetz think this is kind of a lark. They think it's kind of fun and funny, and they're going to get a lot of attention from it, and then everything will sort of drift back to some sort of normality at the end. But this isn't really how that sort of thing goes, is it?
No. And I don't even know if Matt Gaetz wants any kind of normality. This is somebody who most recently showed up at the Iowa State Fair to help Trump radicalize more people. It was a Trump campaign appearance. And everybody's there with their, in their corn dogs, and it's a nice day. And then he says, we're all having fun at the fair, but it's only through force that we will bring any change to corrupt Washington, D.C. I hear that. He's also an election denier. He's also, talking about the right to bear arms. He's a proponent of the coup. And so I hear that as him saying, you know, he's a fanatic, right? That we're not going to have change anymore through elections. We're not going to have change through democratic reform. It's going to be violence. And so he's the spearheading this. And in history, yes, this could come back to haunt him. But what's interesting is it's already come back to haunt the more moderate people who went along with Daddy Trump and became part of the Trump cult and then got in over their head, but still went along with it and now are being threatened, or their wives are sleeping with a loaded gun under their pillow, like, you know, Representative Bacon. And they didn't expect this. But Gaetz is like the fanatic who will be there till the end. It's very dire.
Yeah. And again, my Robespierre analogy is not meant to be facetious, folks. He's the kind of guy who is so far out there that, and at, you know, counter-revolutions and revolutions eat their own very frequently, but only after, I mean, he might get checked eventually, but only after he's released or unleashed a huge swath of, I think, political destruction to our sort of the political character of our country. I mean, I find that, you know, we've got 7 out of the 9 potential candidates for speaker are election deniers.
This is more, I mean, the, you know, it's like the, there isn't one checklist of autocracy, but there are checklists. And I want to be clear that I think that the end game of election denial is to convince the American public that elections are not the best way of deciding on leaders. It's not only that they're corrupt and so we can't have faith in them. And that's been a long, that started even with the Tea Party, but Trump spent a huge amount of time, he invested enormous amount of time discrediting elections. And Michael Flynn is out there right now.
Yes.
Michael Flynn is doing the same. He has an enormous following. Mm-hmm. He's talking about how elections, he said, you know, that Americans no longer have faith in elections. Tommy Tuberville talked about, oh, let's just get rid of elections. This is very serious. This actually goes beyond what somebody like Viktor Orban has, because that's called electoral autocracy. Even Erdogan, who's an awful tyrant and mass jailer, he has elections. These people are saying we shouldn't even have elections, so Trump can truly be their dictator, like old school dictator.
There was an ad that Lincoln Project produced in 21, I guess it was, where Mike Flynn went out and said, you know, they just had a coup, and he pronounced it Myanmar, but okay. They just had a coup in Myanmar. Why don't we do that here?
Yes.
Well, we don't do that here because we're one of the largest and oldest functioning democracies in the world, and that's not what Americans do, traditionally speaking. But I think you see, like there are lessons in the anti-democratic, small-d democratic stresses that this kind of behavior leads to. I mean, I think Israel right now would be in a different position vis-a-vis this war with Hamas, if Netanyahu had not spent the last 2 years with a very tiny divided coalition trying to overturn some of the few remaining roadblocks in Israel's democratic processes and then their judiciary, because that's the sort of sweeping thing. I mean, look, here in America, you might just want to say Leonard Leo did it more smoothly, but Bibi was trying to do the same kind of thing, to take over all the aspects of governance.
Yeah, this is a case study, and Putin is another one. Authoritarians say they're going to defend the country. Putin is always out there with no shirt on. He's the strong man, but they make their countries weaker. They make their countries, they ruin their countries. That's actually a main reason I wrote Strongmen, to show that despite all the propaganda, making the trains run on time, you know, we can bring order to society, they ruin their countries. They cause widespread devastation. And in Netanyahu's case, I wrote a piece on in Lucid, I think called What is the Destiny of Netanyahu? Because he was self-interested, and he actually checks the boxes of some of these autocratic maladies where, you know, his goal was to get back to power, and he did, and get rid of his charges, his judicial problems, his legal problems. And so he was laser focused in a very self-interested way on this judicial reform. And in classic strongman fashion, he didn't really give a crap what happened to the country. And he ignored, this is another thing they all do, and Trump did it, they ignore expert opinion. So he didn't listen to his security people. He didn't listen to his military advisors saying that all of this, and many of them were in the protests, was weakening the military, weakening the security services, and making them less combat ready. And so he contributed in this way to a climate that Hamas then judged as propitious to attack.
You know, it's interesting because a couple of years ago, we were approached to help Gideon Saar and the New Hope Party, which was an attempt to make a post-Bibi center-right party in Israel. And for a lot of reasons, it didn't work, mostly because Bibi has had a stranglehold on that whole cluster of tiny religious parties who make up like plurality almost after Likud of all the remaining potential votes. And so, but it was a lesson some of the messaging we talked about at the time was, you know, are you really going to be safer with Netanyahu sort of burning down all the power structures other than his own and all of the guardrails in the society other than the things he wants to do as a country? And it turned out, you know, the wolves always can smell something when there's a wounded animal out there. They can always find it. And I think we're going to see. It looks like Argentina is going to go with a more authoritarian nationalist. There are a lot of signs around the world that these lessons that authoritarianism is dangerous are being ignored or forgotten or worked around.
Yeah, there are. And it's disheartening that people are so disaffected. And part of this is there are lessons for how we need to reform democracies, because we know that democracies are leaving people atomized, lonely, disaffected. And part of this is democracies that pair with neoliberalism, you know, and people feel that there's something missing in their lives. And along come, I call them shiny objects, like Bukele in El Salvador with crypto, and he's young and he's glamorous. Mm-hmm. Or the crazy route with the crazy hair, which is like the Boris Johnson, you know, a rich aristocratic person. These faux populists, that's something that gets me very angry, that people fall for these fake populists, like the prime minister of Poland, who's talking about, I stand for the people against immigrants. The guy is an international banker, you know, and speaks four languages and went to school in three foreign countries. These are elitists. But they appeal to people because they seem to offer a sense of community. They seem to offer togetherness. It's often by excluding people on hate, you know, by hate. And that's what Trump did. He said, I love you. You're the forgotten. And so he built this community and he gave them MAGA hats. He gave them, you know, outward signifiers of belonging. And people fall for it every time since the fascists. And it is disheartening. It's why I was able to understand what Trump represented in 2015, because I studied fascism.
So speaking of Poland, I mean, most folks have interpreted the most recent election as a little bit of good news, where center-right and center-left and center parties had a little bit of success in pushing back against something that was looking a lot more authoritarian. What's your take on the Polish elections?
Yeah, it was a big deal. It's actually full of really helpful lessons. One is unity. But, you know, there have been attempts by the opposition in other elections in Italy, in Israel, in Hungary, and they had unity, most of them, not some countries, not the degree that you might want. But a lot of times these coalitions went too far to the center right. That happened in Turkey, where the opposition became so anti-immigrant and so harsh against immigration, they lost some people. Poland, they didn't do that. They were center progressive, and they had a progressive message. And this is very important. You know, you have a background in messaging. Optimism. They had a heart symbol. They talked about love. And this can seem hokey to people, but it actually is proven to work. It worked in Turkey in 2019. The guy preached radical love. And in Poland, they appealed. They had, you know, practical things they wanted to give people. They had party programs. But I think that this idea that Donald Tusk said that change is inevitable, change is on the way. It doesn't have to be like this. And it gave people back a sense of faith in their own powers to come out. And they had the biggest march since 1989. That's a big deal. So they did everything right in that regard, principally providing a progressive alternative and not moving to the center right like they did in Hungary and Turkey. And that's not the way to defeat right-wing autocrats, is to mimic them, which has been done too many times.
I think a lot of the takes that I've heard about Poland is they really were, I think they almost like the dog caught the car here. I don't know that they expected to win, but they were desperately trying and experimenting with things to do anything to push back against what had felt like, I think for a lot of folks, and I have some friends in Poland, and some in the political space, but some in the business sector in Poland, who the last few days have been like, well, you know, I'm hoping it's going to be a little less arbitrary, a little less reflexive, a little less about the social warfare stuff, you know, a little more back to governance again, which I think is really like the flag you get is a lot of people on the statist right. And look, I look at like a guy like Ron DeSantis in Florida. Ron is not a conservative. He is a statist. And he wants to use the power of government and the power of the state to achieve his political ends at home. I think when you see that, I mean, that may be one of the things that parties in the center and leaders in the center have to start offering, is a sense of like, look, I'm going to make things work, folks. We're not going to do the crazy stuff. We're not going to just, you know, rattle your cage every day. We're going to pave roads. We're going to build bridges. We're going to open schools. We're going to do the things that a civil society does. I think that in Poland, that's sort of where they have an opportunity space right now.
I think that's right. That's certainly what Biden's been trying to do. And it contrasts hugely with, you know, with people in the GOP who are not interested in governing. Somebody like Jim Jordan, his role, whether in Ohio or in Washington, has been to cover up crime, to enable corruption. And there's been many people have observed, you know, he hasn't produced much legislation, nothing he supported. He's not a productive person as a politician. He's not interested in governing. He's there for other reasons. And increasingly that's what's happened with the GOP, because they have internalized the methods and philosophy of the coup, which is we don't want elections. We bring change through other, you know, means, but we depend on lying. We depend on corruption, because election denial is a form of corruption, by the way. It's defrauding the public. And then we depend on threat to get people. The way that, you know, we govern now is we threaten people to get the votes we need. When that's what you're about, you're no longer interested in governing through policies and platforms that are for the collective good. You're just the minority that wants absolute power.
You know, Ruth, that was a really interesting point you just made, that this election denial is a form of corruption. Say more about that. I think that's a really interesting point.
Yeah, it's really important, because it's too easy to see election denial as just almost like propaganda, because we immediately labeled it the big lie, right? And it is a lie. And that's, by the way, it's extraordinary what Trump pulled off. I actually don't know of anybody else in history who was able to deceive, what is it, 60 million people? I don't know the exact number, but it's tens of millions of people. Work on a major thing that's empirically, you know, verifiable very easily, the presidential election. And he was working in an open society. He wasn't working in a one-party state like the fascists. Then it's easier to do. So anyway, so there's that. So, but that's only part of it. Election denial, which is refusing to vacate your office, refusing to, like Trump did, and then turn to violence, or like Carrie Lake refusing to concede, and propagating this lie. This is defrauding the public. It's getting the public to believe something, and you've acted on it. That's the key. It's not just a belief; it's an action, and that we need to think of it in those terms, because propaganda and corruption work together in the authoritarian playbook.
It is certainly a centerpiece of all their messaging now. It is an absolute cornerstone of everything they say about America today. It's that our elections are fraudulent, they're broken, why should we bother, why shouldn't we go? And these guys at places like Claremont have become increasingly comfortable saying the words that they want to live in a post-small-d democratic world. They want to live in a post-republic America. They want to live in some sort of, and it varies from place to place. Some of them want like a crypto-anarchist tech bro thing. Some of them want an actual authoritarian state. Some of them want a statist approach to our current politics, where instead of being a conservative, which traditionally necessarily meant that you wanted to limit the power and activity of the state in controlling people's lives, some of them have inverted that very heavily. That's the J.D. Vances and the Ron DeSantises. And you know, there's even like a weird super subculture of authoritarianism in America that I'm fascinated and horrified by at the same time, of people who actually want to reestablish some sort of monarchy.
Yeah.
And you know, Thiel and some of those people are flirting with that. And some of those, you know, weird alt-right guys are flirting with it. But the truth of the matter is, in a strange way, in the minds of a lot of MAGA voters, they'd be fine with it if the royalty started with the name T and it was Trump. I mean, they really are post-democracy.
We're only now, the public will look back one day and realize, because that, you know, they have been educated by Trump very intensively by all his allies to hate democracy. And they may have been disaffected with it before, but the, you know, when people say Trump is lazy, he's not lazy at all. He just, he focused very intensely on the things he cared about. One was making money while he was president by going one third of his time. He was spent visiting Trump branded properties, and people were like, oh, he's golfing, he's lazy. No, where is he golfing? He's golfing at Trump-branded properties, so he's helping us. And the other thing was building his loyalty cult, his personality cult, so that he would be believed and have a civilian army if he had a problem and he lost the election, check. And then really re-educating the American population to not believe in elections, to look up to Putin and Xi, and to believe that democracy is failing, it's a source of crime and anarchy. And so he's done this kind of, they all have, this kind of re-education of Americans, and that's how we end up in the situation you just described. It happens over time, and people don't realize as while it's going on. And, you know, if you call it out too early, people do not, they don't have a frame of reference to believe you, or they think you're exaggerating. And all of these people who are advocating for various forms of autocracy, you know, going back to what you said before, there are the fanatics who are pro-violence. A lot of these people are going to be very surprised, because that's what happens in history. They didn't think it would, and in our country, it would be very violent because of all the guns around. And people are not ready for that. So they unleashed something that is going to overcome them.
The unintended consequences of slipping into this are, I mean, and we've only seen it a handful of times in the modern era, in modern memory, you know, Rwanda and Serbia and Kosovo. These things, when they slip and they fall apart faster and more violently than anybody anticipates, which is why keeping up this fight is so very, very important, and why I appreciate your voice so much, Ruth, in the work you do, and the way you've educated a lot of people on that authoritarianism isn't some distant nightmare. It's a very present and very real risk to this country and beyond. So, folks, check out Ruth on social media. But I really, really recommend you subscribe to her Substack. It's called Lucid, and it is a terrific look inside her thinking and the work she does on this incredibly important topic. And Ruth, thank you so much for coming on the Enemies List today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
On the Enemies List today, 7 fucking Republicans. Yes, I use the F word. Oh my God, I'm such a terrible human being. Here's why. Of the 9 Republicans vying as of October 23rd, when I'm recording this, to be Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States of America, 7 of them are election deniers. 7 of them have either told themselves the lie or their constituents the lie, or they're too afraid to speak the truth that they know that this election in 2020 was not stolen. It was not cheated. It was not invalid. It was not dubious. There were no questions about it. Joe Biden beat Donald Trump's ass like a rented mule. Joe Biden won that election. They know it. So the 7 men who are on this list of people who think they should be the Speaker of the House, you are on the enemies list. As long as you deny the reality that Donald Trump lost the election, there's a fundamental dishonesty at the very core of everything you are politically. There's a fundamental dishonesty about everything you could ever hope to do politically. You would say it in private, and I know some of you have said it in private. Oh, yeah, you know Trump lost, but I can't say it out loud. Well, you should say it out loud. You should just have a moment where you man up. You should have a moment where you dig down deep and find a scintilla of moral courage to tell the American people the truth and say, Donald Trump was not cheated. Joe Biden won the election fair and square. The attack on the Capitol on 1-6 was not justified. None of these 7 people will do it. They are a representative sector of the most morally vacant human beings to have ever darkened the door of American politics. Not one of them deserves to be Speaker, and I hope none of them make it. Thanks again for listening to The Enemies List. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.